be seated. Good afternoon. I'm delighted to welcome you all for our third argument today, 10 AP 1366 CR State versus James G. Brereton. Arguing for Mr. Brereton is Matthew S. Pinnix. That'll be 25 minutes. Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General, arguing with the state, will have 30 minutes, and Mr. Pinnix, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, opposing counsel, I am Matthew Pinnix, and I speak on behalf of James Brereton. Mr. Brereton's case comes before this court as a search and seizure case with a number of issues briefed to the court. I'm going to begin my remarks this afternoon somewhat out of the order that they were presented in the briefs and jump right to the search with a GPS tracking device and whether the search exceeded the scope of the warrant that was issued to authorize its use. In this case, law enforcement agents came to believe that Mr. Brereton was involved in some burglarious activity going on in the fall of 2007 in rural Walworth and Rock counties. They decided that it would assist them in their investigation to attach a GPS tracking device to Mr. Brereton's car and follow him around for a while to see whether or not
Counsel, I think you just made reference to Mr. Brereton's car, and that's a question that's on my mind in this case. What does the record tell us about his connection to this vehicle?
Justice Gableman, I think the record is clear that Mr. Brereton was connected to the vehicle, that he was using it at least with the owner's consent.
What's in the record to show that it was with the owner's consent?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, to be honest, the record is somewhat scant, and I think that goes to the issue of forfeiture of the standing argument that the state has raised.
I'm asking you just a very practical question, just a very sort of nuts and bolts. What is it we have in the record to show that he was operating with consent?
Sure. The car was registered to an address in Beloit, Wisconsin, and it was found there by law enforcement officers. During surveillance of that house, they saw Mr. Brereton and the co-defendant in this case come out, get in the car, drive off. Each time they stopped the car, Mr. Brereton was driving it, both to install the GPS tracking device, and then subsequently when they had found out that some burglaries had occurred, he was the driver. Additionally, when they took the car to first install the device, they peered in through the window and saw some property that, at the end of the day, they found out belonged to Mr. Brereton. That property that was in the car at the time that it was stopped was also in a truck that unquestionably belonged to Mr. Brereton. Amongst those things was the Brereton wedding video. The property in the car, the use of it, is demonstrative of the fact that he had the owner's permission. Now, this is not a car that was ever reported stolen. The police never impounded it as a stolen vehicle. We have no reason to believe that it was stolen, but rather that it was being properly used. And for that reason, I believe that the record is clear that Mr. Brereton was using the car, at least with the permission of the owner. And it's not the type of thing that the state has suggested where he's loosely connected to it. So they have this car, and they want to put the GPS tracking device onto it. And they go to the judge in Walworth County, and they say, "Judge, we want to use a GPS tracking device that will do certain things." And specifically, they say, "This device will periodically record location data, hold that information until such time that the device can later be retrieved from the vehicle. And then once that device is taken back to the Sheriff's Department, it can be uploaded to a computer and overlaid on a map to show a historical catalog of the routes traveled, places stopped, etc." the judge, who's been informed about this intrusion, has to balance the government's proposed intrusion and the stated need for it against Mr. Brereton's constitutional rights. And we know, because the order was issued, that the judge believed that what was requested was reasonable under the circumstances. Signs an order, says go forth, attach the GPS device, and track him as you will. That is, in Mr. Brereton's opinion, where things begin to go awry. The law enforcement officers go to the car and attach a different device, a device that does more than the one that they represented to the judge in pursuit of the warrant.
Mr. Penix, does the record reflect at all how that happened, why they ended up with a more sophisticated device?
It does not. And we just have to take it for a fact that they used a different one. The Court of Appeals concluded that it was different. I believe the state in its briefing and Mr. Brereton have all conceded that it was different. They were non-identical. And the way that they were non-identical is the one that was used was capable of a continual 24-hour-a-day constant recording of Mr. Brereton's location. The transmission of that information from wherever the vehicle was back to, we know at least, the Walworth County Sheriff's Department, and a computer that was attached that had some receiving capability. Now, I say that we know at least to the Walworth County Sheriff's Department because the record also demonstrates that one of the officers proposed to track the car using live tracking methodology on his laptop from his home. So it was able to demonstrate his location constantly in a way that the other device was unable to do. It gave an immediate access to law enforcement, to his whereabouts, whereby they were able to know where he had been, where he immediately was, and with some inference, where he was going. And this continued for a series of 5 days where they were able to monitor where he was going. That key distinction, I think, the collection of more quantitative data in addition to the transmission.
Did it collect more data, or did it just allow for the more immediate, contemporaneous detection of that? Because my understanding of this is that either device would have revealed all this information, except the one first contemplated would have required the periodic removal and replacement by law enforcement and its attendant delays.
Justice Gableman, I believe that my interpretation of the record is somewhat different. The affidavit describing the device says that it takes periodic recording at selected intervals. In my opinion, that suggests something quite different than the continual monitoring that we have in this case, in a way that, as I mentioned before, because of the greater quantity, makes a qualitative difference. And I say that because I think we also have to consider the attendant software, the transmission capability, and the immediacy when we are trying to determine the differences in these devices. Because
is there anything in the record that shows that the law enforcement officers were trying to mislead the judge, that they were selling him a bill of goods as to the type of device, and they substituted something else by whim?
I would not want to go so far, Justice Crooks. I do not think that the record would support that, but I do think what the record supports is that somewhere between asking to use the device and actually installing it, there was a difference that occurred, and I can't say why.
What's the significance of that?
The significance is because the device that was actually used was able to more substantially intrude on Mr. Brereton's privacy, and the judge who signed the order was responsible for deciding whether the stated need to intrude outweighed the privacy interests. And so if a judge doesn't know what the device is going to do when that judge signs the order, the judge can't meaningfully balance the intrusion against the stated need. So there cannot be a warrant that is constitutionally, there cannot be a warrant that is undergirded by that fundamental balancing test based on an accurate understanding of what the device was going to do.
Well, in essence, wasn't each of the devices doing the same thing in the sense that they were giving the law enforcement officers information as to where your client was going with this particular vehicle?
I think, Justice Crooks, that they were doing something quite different. I think to simply look at the information that was collected and say that it was the same information is an incomplete analysis of the devices as they operated. Because remember, the device that was actually used allowed an immediate access to Mr. Brereton's whereabouts that gave a more substantial mosaic of his personal history to the government agents than would have been available under the other device.
Counsel, a more substantial mosaic is lovely prose, but what does it mean here?
Justice Bradley, it means that they knew more about Mr. Brereton than they would have otherwise known.
In what way? Give me concrete facts.
When I think about this device in this case, it's, I think, in some ways difficult to just look at this GPS device. So if I may offer an analogy. Take, for example, a circumstance in which law enforcement agents had said, Judge, we believe an individual is involved in some illicit activity, and we want to put a static camera in a particular location that will periodically take photographs of this location. And the judge says, well, that makes sense given what you've told me may be going on. I think that these pictures, periodic pictures, would be a non-substantial intrusion on the privacy. And then the law enforcement agents go out and put a video camera that records continuously what is going on, sends that information immediately to a computer, a law enforcement agent somewhere who can then watch what is going on instantaneously. So we have not only a greater quantity of information where the static camera would take limited photographs and the video is a running video, we also have a fundamental difference in kind of evidence that's obtained because of the video capability of demonstrating this constant visual understanding of what we couldn't get from individual framed photos. And I think that the analogy here is that the officers asked to use what would effectively be a static camera, and they used the video camera.
Let me just ask you this. Suppose that the warrant had described this GPS accurately. Would that warrant be valid?
Your Honor, I believe the reason that we are here today is because the warrant did not accurately describe the device.
But suppose it had.
I think that would, if they had gone out and used the device consistent with what they described, I don't have a problem with it. I'm not here today to argue that.
The device, with all of its nuances and its ability to record and transmit instantly, then is valid if you got the proper warrant.
Yes.
Okay, my next question is, so your real point is that the warrant wasn't executed properly because
yes.
It didn't conform with the language of the warrant. Well, how can you make that argument, frankly, in light of Sveum? In Sveum, you had a warrant that was did not follow the statute. Right? Didn't. Statute had requirements. The warrant didn't follow it. Right? And the application didn't follow it. The warrant said you can do it once. They went back, I think, if I remember, Sveum, three times and put in new GPSs. The statute said you got to bring back the information in X number of days. And you have X number of days to do the search. They had this GPS on for a long time. I've forgotten the number of days. Now, so you have a You have in Sveum a warrant that doesn't fit the statute. You have an execution in Sveum that doesn't fit the warrant. And the court says, hey, it's okay. So what is it about this one that distinguishes from Sveum? Now, in Jones, the court decided we got a search if we put on a GPS. That was an assumption in Sveum. Well, now we know it's a search. So there's no question there was a search. They got a warrant. They didn't execute the search in the manner set forth in the warrant. And the issue is that unreasonable? Isn't that the issue here?
Yes.
So what's so unreasonable? Well, it would have been a valid execution of the warrant if the device had been described. You say that. So they went a little further. I mean, Sveum went much further than the warrant, and the warrant went much further than the statute, and the court said it was A-OK. So I don't know what this case is doing here. That's not good voting for you. So tell me why this is so important in light of Sveum.
Thank you, Chief Justice. In my understanding, Sveum addressed an issue that is not the one that's currently before this court.
It's not what?
Currently before this court.
Which is
what? I say that because in Sveum, the question was whether it was in compliance with the statute, is my understanding, and whether because it did not comply in the
But there was no warrant, right?
Correct.
Does this comply with the statute?
No, I believe that State versus Sveum would indicate that this order is a proper warrant.
Yeah.
I believe that the law is...
Doesn't have to comply with the statute to be a proper warrant.
That would be my understanding, Your Honor.
Right. Well, suppose there was no statute at all authorizing the court to issue a warrant because the statute was unconstitutional, we struck it down. Does that mean no warrants could be issued in the state of Wisconsin?
No, Your Honor. I guess my point that I'm getting to with regard to the difference between this case and Sveum is that this case is about what the judge knew at the time that the judge issued the warrant. And the break that occurs when what was told to the judge is different than what was done.
Well, what was the judge told? I think this is what Justice Crooks was driving at. What was told to the judge that the judge relied on in giving the warrant that makes the warrant defective because the judge wasn't told the whole truth and nothing but the truth? I think that was one. At least as I understood it, the question that Justice Crooks was saying to you.
What I think the problem is that, and if we can look to the petitioner's appendix and find precisely what it was that the judge was told, and there's language that says exactly what the device is going to do, namely, as I commented earlier, these periodic recordings, et cetera. And quite frankly, that is significantly different than what was done in this case. And because the judge was told one thing, and another thing was done, that to me demonstrates that the order that was issued when they went beyond the representations that had been made to the judge, that execution was outside the scope. And in my opinion, I don't think Sveum is determinative of the issue because, as Your Honor pointed out, it was assumed to have been a seizure. But in this particular case, everyone's admitting that the device was put on, and we know, pursuant to Jones, that it is a seizure. But the fundamental question before this court is a search issue, not a seizure issue. It's whether the use of the GPS tracking device to invade Mr. Brereton's privacy constitutes a search, and whether, because it was more invasive, it violated the warrant based on the representations. Frankly, if law enforcement is going to go to a judge with the specific purpose of getting a warrant for a singular purpose, namely in this case to use a GPS tracking device.
Well, counsel, Judge Carlson in his order, and I'm reading from the order at appendix page 90. This is the petitioner's appendix, APP appendix 90. He authorized law enforcement, quote, to install use, maintain, and conduct surveillance and monitoring of the location and movement of the target vehicle in all places within or outside the jurisdiction of Walworth County. This includes but is not limited to private residences and other locations not open to visual surveillance. To accomplish the installation, officers are authorized to obtain and periodically go in and replace. And then the distinction that you draw in your brief at pages 37 and 38, you say the affidavit that was used to obtain the order made no mention of the fact, one, the GPS tracking device would send text message alerts to law enforcement whenever it began or ceased to move. Two, it is mute regarding the device's ability to transmit its location in real time to a remote receiver that could instantaneously analyze the transmission and display the device's location on a computerized map. I'm not seeing a terrific inconsistency between what the judge authorized and what you just articulated is a significant difference. What I'm seeing is more of a timing issue when we compare what he authorized to what was put in.
I think that in analyzing this order, we can look at the totality of it, and quite frankly, I think that the language itself is vague and perhaps inconsistent. We have a circumstance in the paragraph where it says that the state's request to install and monitor a tracking device on the below-listed vehicle is granted based on the authority in United States versus Carroll. And then the paragraph that Your Honor just read then begins to explain how they don't need to comply with Carroll, that Carroll doesn't have anything to do with this, and they can, in fact, go directly against what its mandates would require. Additionally, if we look further up in the order, it says that they can install tracking devices. But that's not clear precisely what it is that they are allowed to install, and we have to go to the affidavit that was filed to understand what that language means, because it's not clear.
We can't just look to the language that the judge used at the bottom paragraph?
The bottom paragraph of
pages 9 through 10. But anyway, I'm sorry. Please proceed.
No, I mean, quite frankly, I don't think that the language in the order itself is sufficient to give indication as to what is being authorized, and that is why I'm saying that the affidavit has to be looked to, because the affidavit determines
The language in the order is not sufficient to determine what is authorized?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think, quite frankly, that the affidavit itself is determinative by the very fact that the government agents who were seeking it made a limitation. They put in there specifically what the device would do and thereby limited. This order also, I think if you look at the fact that it's got paragraph 22, closed paren, is a cut paste from the affidavit. The last paragraph in the affidavit is paragraph 21. The paragraph 22 shows up in the order. I think they have to be considered together. And I think that when we look at it that way, we can clearly see that it's a more intrusive search than was authorized in the order. And I understand that I am running short on time, and it would be unfortunate if I were not to address somewhat the issue with regard to whether it constitutes a search, because I know that the United States decision in Knox has been read by the Court of Appeals in Sveum to indicate that the use of a GPS tracking device to follow somebody around on a public thoroughfare doesn't constitute a search. And quite frankly, I don't think that if we look closely at the language of Knox, that is any limitation to this court concluding that the use of a GPS tracking device actually constitutes a search. I say that because in Knox, law enforcement used a very limited technology for a very limited purpose to track an individual from one place to another. They tracked the defendant in Knox on one trip. The court, when they were analyzing the propriety of that, said that a person has no reasonable expectation of privacy in their travel on public thoroughfare from one place to another. The issue that Brereton is arguing is that it is the mosaic. It is from place to place to place to place to place, and not one place to another. In addition, in Knotts, when the defendant cried wolf and said, if you do not determine this to be a search, you're going to allow the 24-hour day warrantless surveillance of any citizen in this country. And the court said, the reality does not suggest abuse. If it comes to pass that in the future, the warrantless surveillance of an individual for 24 hours a day is a reality, we may have to analyze the constitutional principles that apply. For that reason, because the technologies are different, and because Knox was a very limited analysis, it's my understanding that it's a search. And I would just comment to this court that in Jones, five justices of the United States Supreme Court concurred and said that they would ultimately determine it to be a search. I see my light is on. If the court has any questions, I'll answer them. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Brien?
May it please the court. There are three pillars upon which rests any valid search. One, reasonable police conduct. Two, the existence of probable cause. And three, a warrant issued by a neutral and detached magistrate based upon that probable cause compiled by reasonable police conduct. That is precisely what we have in this case. That is why the search was reasonable. That is why the conduct of police was eminently reasonable. That is why the warrant was valid. With regard to the question of reasonableness, I direct this court to the appendix in the petition, in Mr. Brereton's brief, the affidavit of Officer Deputy Schultz, pages 90 through 99 of the appendix, or 92 through 99, and the report of Deputy Sharp, pages 100 through 113 of the appendix. I ask the court to thoroughly read those documents and then ask itself whether the police were acting reasonably here. I think after you do so, there's only one answer, and that answer is manifestly yes. Those, we want to talk about a mosaic. Officer Sharp's report paints a mosaic in vivid detail before the search warrant was even applied for. A mosaic of Mr. Brereton's and Mr. Conaway's activities in this blue Pontiac that was registered to a woman in Clinton, Wisconsin, who we know nothing about in the days leading up to this pretext stop. And that application included the pretext stop and included the information obtained during that that pretext stop, which included the VIN number on the car that didn't match the VIN number on the expired Illinois license plates that someone attached to Miss Bloyer's car, whoever she is. And on the question of probable cause, well, I just answered that. There was probable cause developed before the traffic stop, during the traffic stop, and after the traffic stop. Reasonableness, probable cause. Then on that probable cause, was it reasonable to seize that car? Of course. Was it reasonable to then move it to a nearby impound lot to await issuance of the warrant, to install the GPS device? Of course. The cases are legion that allow for a car to be searched and seized on probable cause, starting with the seminal Carroll case in 1927, I believe it was, or 1925.
What are the grounds for taking that car? It stopped because of traffic violations, right? Well, car violations.
Correct.
Turns out that neither the driver nor the passenger has a valid license, right? Turns out that the VIN number doesn't match the license plate number. Okay. Does that authorize impounding and removal from the street?
Well, I'm...
You can't let them drive the car.
Let's disregard the burglary evidence, just the traffic evidence.
Right.
You have two people who can't drive the car. Do you leave it alongside the highway until someone we don't know who comes and gets it? I mean, it seems to me it's not unreasonable for police to say, We have to move this car off the highway. Now, whether you move it a block or several miles, it seems to me you move it to await whatever happens, whatever that person, that driver decides to do with it, okay. Or if they're unwilling to do anything with it, then you... That would be my belief. And then, but here, you
so
add
on to it.
It's perfectly
valid for the cops to take to tow that car away and put it in a place. Could the owner of the car easily taken that car out of that lot? I mean, is the lot locked up so that you can't get at any of these cars?
My understanding is that this was, I have nothing to indicate that this was a locked lot. Now,
so they could have left it on a street next to the highway and not in violation of some parking rules, right?
They could have, and they also could have exposed themselves to liability if someone damaged that car. While
or liability if it's damaged in this lot.
Pardon me?
Or liability if it's damaged in this lot to which they took the car.
Right. Well, it was an impound lot, Davis Towing or something, but it sounded, from what I gather from the record, it's a place that they I assume, have some sort of a contractual relationship with to store cars, so I assume that there's some liability protection.
You don't see any problem in taking possession of this car?
No, and I'll give you a case on point, U.S. Supreme Court, Chambers v. Maroney, okay. Which, interestingly, is not cited in Mr. Brereton's briefs in this court, but was cited and discussed in the post-conviction brief filed by Mr. Brereton, I think it's at page 18 of the appendix, where Chambers expressly authorizes, once you have probable cause, and because it's a readily mobile car, you can either hold the car and await issuance of a warrant or move it. And I think it's footnote 10 of the opinion says it was not unreasonable for police to move the car to the police station from the scene of the busy highway. And I think that's precisely what happened here. We had probable cause to believe this car was used in a crime. You need to, it's now evidence. You're not only protecting yourself from civil liability for damaging someone else's car, you're protecting evidence of a crime by moving it off the highway.
The same probable cause that you get for a warrant for the GPS.
Yes.
How far afield does the device have to be from that which is authorized in the warrant before we would determine that the search exceeded the scope of the warrant? Give me an example where you would be coming in and confessing error.
Perhaps some of the hypotheticals that Mr. Pinnock discusses, where you have a device that would pick up, that is intended only to pick up thermal, heat registry in a house, but it also allows you to see what the people are doing, and you would learn evidence of what those people are doing on top of what it was, something that's way, it's far more, it has more capabilities. It does more things and enables you to see more things. Something that allows audio monitoring, but it also here you're doing visual monitoring. Something along those lines. I think he relies heavily on the Penders decision out of the Court of Appeals. And we're discussing that you exceed the scope when you act in flagrant disregard, or at least you exceed the scope. You suppress the evidence. All of the evidence seized if you act in flagrant disregard. It would have to be that type of a device where you could look at that device and say, well, by using that, they acted in flagrant disregard of what was authorized,
well,
as opposed to something that's just different or does a better job of doing what was authorized.
So is a guideline for law enforcement and the courts then, as long as you have a warrant that is akin to the SPEAM warrant, this warrant was akin to the very warrant used in SPEAM, that pretty much you can use as technology advances that which is the state of the art. Is that the lesson that we take here? As long as you have a warrant that is...
the requirement, the Dahlia of the United States in those cases require that if you're going to exceed the scope, it's still, the officer does have discretion, but it's, if you're going to exceed the scope, it has to be reasonable. So I guess, you know, that's a case-by-case analysis. I mean, what was reasonable in one case, you know, it might change with technology as technology changes. And as we know, these devices are changing constantly.
One of the concerns I have, and I think it was in the Sabeem case that several of the justices called upon the legislature or were concerned that we need some guidance. And yet, you know, our role is to be guardians of the Constitution, and the Fourth Amendment is an exceedingly important part of the Constitution. So are we always going to be behind the game? That is, we have a fact situation, and we focus on that fact, and then another fact situation comes so that we're going to have, as technology advances, this being the genre de jour of cases, because we're going to deal with them fact or by fact, or are we going to have any overarching principles from a court dealing with the nexus between what's in the warrant and the advancement of technology?
Well, I mean, certainly the legislature could specifically define certain specific devices. Obviously, that legislation would also have to change to keep up with time. But the overarching principle has always been reasonableness. What is reasonable? And that, again, ties into what device you're using, what device was authorized, what the police were doing with it, what they obtained with it, all of that. Comes in. So that is, you know, and we know all the Terry v. Ohio cases, it's always a question of reasonableness, and that's why we have so many of them. You know, certainly the legislature could act and become very specific and try to define things. I'll tell you, though, we already have some guidance here, and that's on the Court of Appeals Sabeem decision, paragraphs 23 through 30 of that decision. Mr. Sabeem argued that the device in that case, which was the same as the device asked for but not used here, the one that was not the real-time device, the one discussed in the warrant application, was the device actually used in Sabeem. And Mr. Sabeem made the argument that that was not a tracking device on the electronic surveillance control law because that law contemplates a real-time tracking device, the reverse of the flip side of this argument. And yet the Court of Appeals says, either way, they're both tracking devices. They're both GPS tracking devices. They achieve the same purpose. And that's what we have here. We have one device that's, yes, technically more advanced than the other, arguably, or at least technically different than the other. I'm not sure which quality of information is actually better. But the fact is, as the Court of Appeals plainly said in Sabeem, these devices, at least for purposes of the electronic surveillance law, are tracking devices, and therefore they're exempt, whether one's real-time or not.
So there's it's of little importance the degree of invasiveness of the device, as long as they're for tracking?
Is that counsel talks about the degree of invasiveness, but judge authorized this degree of invasiveness. He authorized tracking the location of that car as best as they could with GPS tracking technology. And that's what happened. That's the information they got. In 4 days, they tracked the location of this car. You know, this discussion of the mosaic, you refer to it as flowery language or lovely language. Let's not forget we have a warrant here. And so if there is a mosaic that's created by this device, it's because it was authorized on probable cause by a judge. That's wholly different than the Jones situation or the Knott situation where you have no warrant, you don't have probable cause.
Well, the defendant is, as I understand the argument, agrees is a warrant. And as I understand the defendant's argument, the defendant agrees that it's a valid warrant under Sabeem in the sense that, although it may not fit the statute, it's a warrant that has an electronic device. So I understand the argument. I understand the argument. Defendant says, yeah, but this warrant wasn't executed. What was executed was a device that is not described in the warrant. Now, the warrant in Sveum also described a device, and that was put on. So this is, as I understand the case, is an execution issue. Was this warrant executed according to the terms of the warrant? And they say no, because you have a device that is more intrusive and is able to record more and can do it instantly, which would enable the police to go out instantly and get evidence, more evidence, different evidence, search a house, do something. Do you understand the case the way I do?
Well, first of all, with regard to the Sveum case, I think, as you pointed out in addressing counsel's argument, you think the court, that warrant was that was executed differently than what was authorized, and I believe in your dissenting opinion, if I recall at paragraph 100, you believe that warrant, that the as executed, the device used might have actually been more intrusive than the device authorized.
But the court didn't buy that. The court did not buy that argument. The court said it's close enough to fit the Fourth Amendment. Isn't that
correct?
Right.
Well, and I think we're missing a major point here. As this court said in the Patron case, and as the Court of Appeals recently said in the Penders case, again, upon which Brereton relies, if you obtain evidence outside the scope of that warrant, then that evidence only must be suppressed. And you suppress everything only if executing that outside the scope was in flagrant disregard of the warrant scope. Here, there was no evidence obtained outside of the scope of the warrant. The warrant authorized obtaining tracking the location of this Pontiac for the next 60 days. That's what the GPS device did. That's what it obtained. There was no other. You know, I guess I could imagine using his hypothetical, if that GPS device somehow is able to peer into the house and see him purchasing cocaine from someone, that evidence might be suppressible because it's outside the scope. But you wouldn't go also suppress the tracking information where he's parked in front of a burglarized home 4 days later. And so, you know, I think we're really making much ado about nothing here, because regardless of the nature of the GPS device used, the information he'd actually obtained was precisely what the Judge Carlson expected it to obtain, or agree that police have made probable cause showing that it would obtain.
Just a different form, that's all. That's the state's position. Just a different form.
And I think Justice Crooks asked why did this happen? I appreciate counsel's concession that he doesn't think it was anything but an honest mistake, and I think that's correct, because after all, this is a form affidavit. As he said, it's identical to the Sveum affidavit. Had they put in that affidavit, we have a real-time tracking device that will better be able to even more capably track this Pontiac based on the probable cause we have. I sincerely believe Judge Carlson would have still issued the warrant. In fact, he might have been more convinced.
So would you suggest that your training person in the Department of Justice, when they train law enforcement, that Mr. Perlman say, hey, we don't know what the next tracking device is going to be next week that we're going to be buying or that's going to come on the market. So instead of saying, hey, we want tracking device number 3254 that does blah, 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 which is what the affidavit here did, as I understand it, that what the law enforcement should say, we got probable cause and define that, and then say, we want to track this GPS, track this car, and we'll put on a tracking device that will inform where this car is at any time. Why does the warrant have to say any more than that? And then the affidavit, and then the judge says, you may put on a GPS or another device that may have a different name that will track in some form or other this car
because you've shown probable cause, et cetera. Is that good enough for the affidavit, and is it good enough for the warrant?
My answer in light of that, especially in light of the Court of Appeals discussion of tracking devices and spam, is that that would be appropriate, that that would be sufficient to, because you are specifically asking for permission to attach a GPS tracking device for the purpose of tracking the movements of the car. And I think that that, without having to, you know, if they want to be more thorough and they know precisely what device they're using, sure, they could go on and say, we're using a GPS model X number 3, which does this, that, and the other thing. But we're achieving the same end, to track the location of the car.
The Fourth Amendment doesn't require all this detail, right?
That's correct.
Fourth Amendment has rather what the clause requires, that warrant particularly describe the place to be searched. So it does. It says, hey, this car, we're putting the device on the car, right? And that's the place searched. And what the items to be seized are, it doesn't quite fit anymore because that's not, because the Fourth Amendment was written before these electronic devices. But it, in effect, says, hey, this is the information. That's the items to be seized, and that's how we're going to get it, and we don't have to say any more. That would save a lot of trouble. We won't get this kind of case again.
Well, it could, yeah. I mean, I think we're, you know, a device that will achieve the purpose of the warrant. And again, if you, you know, the manner of execution is reasonable. You know, do the officers, when a judge authorizes a no-knock entry to a house, does the judge have to be told how many officers will be used to go in? 4, 8, 1? You know, no, that's up in the, that's in the hands of the officers who are executing that warrant. You have to do it reasonably. Now, if they use an explosive device to enter the house, they might have exceeded the scope and might have acted unreasonably, depending on the circumstances. But, you know, so I mean, you're still looking at the reasonableness of the police conduct. But as far as what the warrant authorizes, I think, I believe you could be far more general than what this warrant was, and still be well within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment.
Would it be within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment to have a generic tracking device, but in some ways attached to or embedded in the clothing of a suspect?
Pursuant to warrant?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess if you have probable cause, you know, again, that's what distinguishes this case from Knotts and Jones and those Supreme and Carroll, which were warrantless cases where there wasn't probable cause, or arguably was not probable cause, at best reasonable suspicion. Here, if you present enough sufficient information to a judge based on probable cause to authorize placing a device in the person's clothing, I believe because of you're going through a magistrate, because you've got probable cause, and because you're asking for a warrant, the judge could authorize that depending on whether the facts support it.
Even the probable cause without any assessment or accountability of the degree of invasiveness. As long as you had probable cause, that's it.
Well, again, if you are, you know, it depends on, the type of crime you're investigating. I think I think, again, you have to convince the judge. And of course, there are the cases dealing with telephone wiretapping authorizations where they have specific probable cause to intercept conversations, but, of course, sometimes because they're able to tap the wire, they intercept conversations that were outside the scope of what the warrant contemplated. That's permissible. You can't use the evidence that those conversations give you outside the scope of the warrant, but it doesn't invalidate the whole warrant. And I think that's what you'd have here. If you put a device in his clothing because all the suspected burglary reports say he wore a red Wisconsin jacket, a man with a red Wisconsin jacket was seen outside the houses of these burglarized houses, and the judge issues a warrant authorizing you to put a device inside that red Wisconsin jacket, and you also find that that jacket takes you to him dealing drugs or something like that, you may or there may be a problem in scope. However, that doesn't invalidate the part, the evidence that shows that he committed another burglary wearing that jacket, it seems to me. That doesn't invalidate the warrant. It just dictates what evidence may and may not come in that's obtained while that warrant, while that activity is going on pursuant to the warrant.
What about a bicycle? Do we do the same thing on a bicycle?
That with the same thing, you mean a GPS device on a bicycle?
Sure. Bikes.
I don't see why not. I mean, the Jones case talks about carriages, so I guess a bicycle, if you're on a public thoroughfare, or even if you're not. I mean, again, let's get away from Jones.
That bicycle is going to take me into a personal garage.
Well, if the warrant can authorize you to go inside a house, it can authorize you to go inside a garage, and it can authorize you to go inside a car. That's the difference. That's why we shouldn't get hung up on Jones and Knotts. Those are warrantless searches.
I agree. This has got a warrant.
This is on probable cause. If you have probable cause to go in that house, you can issue a warrant to say, go in that house. So the bicycle in the garage, I don't see a problem as long as you have probable cause. And you convince the judge, as Judge Carlson was convinced here, that you can go inside that car and install that GPS device, and you can track that car wherever it goes, even in garages, because you prove that it is and may contain evidence of a burglary, of burglaries, and may be used in the future in the commission of burglaries. So, yes, what if it's in the garage of one of the burglarized houses? Do we not allow that evidence in, even though the warrant authorized you to track it into that garage? Somebody's private property.
So this warrant authorizes going into private residences. What about a device that monitors or tracks activity within your home?
Well, that's the Kylo situation. And again, you have... And that was a warrantless situation as well, where
with
police...
With a warrant. I'm talking about with probable cause.
I'm sorry?
I'm talking about with a warrant. I mean, is there no concern, as long as you have probable cause, which is a pretty low threshold, as our cases indicate, as long as you have probable cause, a tracking or a monitoring device can be placed for a finite period of time, let's say 60 days, within your residence. Any problem with that as long as you have probable cause?
I'm confused. What crime are we investigating?
If
he's burglarizing other houses, I don't know where that gets you.
Something dealing with housing minors or activity involving minors in the home over a period of time.
Would it be a GPS, or would it transcribe conversation?
A GPS
monitoring device. I don't know.
I mean, I guess I don't understand. I don't know why you would ever ask for that. A GPS device that proves that he's at home.
I'm saying a monitoring device. I'm going from a GPS to a different kind of electronic monitoring or tracking, if you will, where what's going on in the home.
Well, in that situation, now you have different facts. In that situation, there might very well be valid justification to put even, like his hypothetical, something that has both audio and visual capabilities to show what he's doing with these minors that are going in and out of his house. The home is sacred under the Fourth Amendment, and the Supreme Court has made that crystal clear. Even so, hundreds of warrants are issued for entry into homes every day.
Well, this one includes private residence, authorization to go into private residence, doesn't it? I thought it did.
To install a device. I think it was, any private area to install a device, but I think it also allowed tracking into private areas.
It includes but is not limited to private residence and the et cetera.
But just putting it in the car is a search, isn't it?
Jones said it's a trespass on the personal effect of the car's owner, basically, is what Jones says. And that makes it a search in the eyes of the majority in Jones.
And that's why you can't put the GPS into a car unless you get a warrant.
Or exigent circumstances.
Oh, or an exception to the warrant.
That's correct.
What's your position? I'm sorry. Are we?
And so I don't know why we're discussing, why counsel is discussing care or not, because Jones settled that question. It is a search. And these officers were quite reasonable in not following the Court of Appeals decision in Swaim, which said you didn't need a warrant. They went out and got a warrant, even though they at the time of the search they didn't have to.
Now, Swaim, we reviewed Swaim, right?
Yes, and you upheld it on the ground that the order was valid, the equivalent of a search warrant.
All right. With the assumption that it was a search. So does the Department of Justice look at and consider good law matters in Court of Appeals decisions that have been reviewed by this court? I mean, you're relying on a Court of Appeals decision when we have our own decision.
Correct. It was not overruled. Swaim was upheld by this court on different grounds than the basis for the decision.
I just wanted you to know what the practice of the DOJ is.
Well, our office tells officers to get a warrant.
No, I meant about use of Court of Appeals decisions that have been reviewed by our court.
You know, I know there's been a lot of law on this area lately, and I really
I
guess I'm not prepared to take the office's position. I guess my view is that when a decision is affirmed on one ground and the other ground is not addressed, that it can still be that second ground can still be. But it's no longer good law after Jones, so it's beside the point.
Okay. Thank you. Counsel, just so I'm clear about your position, you're not attacking the impounding of this car, are you?
Yes, first issue that was argued in the briefing, and the argument was made that there's not probable cause to seize the vehicle. And if I may just key on that.
But if there were probable cause, they could seize that.
Yes, that's correct.
But they can't seize it just because there's a violation of a traffic ticket, a traffic ordinance?
Right, that's my argument. I mean, I believe that the seizure needed to be accompanied by probable cause to establish that it was either evidence of or had evidence in it that was demonstrative of the burglaries.
Was there different probable cause when they impounded that car than when they got the warrant?
Well, they were arguably able to learn things that they then included in the warrant, namely the VIN number that didn't match the plates. If we look over, the police reports seem to suggest that they didn't peer into the car and get the VIN number.
But that's not probable cause to think there was that this car or the occupant was in a burglary.
Right.
So what was the probable cause as to the burglary that they learned from after they impounded the car?
I don't know that there is any additional probable cause beyond that.
So if there's no probable cause to impound it on the burglary charge, then there's no probable cause for the warrant.
That is Brereton's position.
Pardon me?
That is our position, Your Honor.
That is your position.
If I could just address something that the state addressed with regard to Jones that I think needs clarified. The state was asked whether Jones established that this was a search, and I think that it doesn't. Jones was a seizure case, and I'll admit that the language of Jones is somewhat vague or unclear at points because they use the term interchangeably. But as this court is well aware, there are different standards associated with a seizure and a search, and Jones specifically addressed whether the attachment of the device constituted a meaningful intrusion into his property, and then concluded because it was a meaningful intrusion, it constituted, and they said search, okay? But I believe that a close read of the language would suggest that it's a seizure and therefore within the province of the Fourth Amendment. Now, What Brereton is challenging here is not the seizure that occurred when they attached the device to his car, because arguably the record doesn't support any outside of the scope attachment of the device. For example, I can't say that they hooked it up to his battery or something like that. The argument that I am making is that the device was capable of more significantly intruding on his right to privacy than the other device. I don't believe that Jones decides that issue, and I think, quite frankly, this court has the opportunity to first decide whether it constitutes a search to follow somebody around with a GPS tracking device. And I think that's a key distinction here. There was a lot of discussion about reasonableness by the state. And Madam Chief Justice, you asked whether the Fourth Amendment required them to specifically define the device that they would use in their affidavit, and I agree with the state that it does not.
That's right.
But they did, in this case, do that. And in my opinion, that is what causes the problem. The very fact that they told the judge, here is how we are going to have a limited intrusion on Mr. Brereton's right to privacy, that then turned out not to be the case, in my opinion, is the distinction here that causes the execution of the warrant to be outside of the scope. The judge who determined that the need to intrude was reasonable in light of Mr. Brereton's right to privacy believed that a limited intrusion would be occurring to Mr. Brereton's privacy in a limited way. And because the judge who signed that warrant, and this is going to occur more frequently now because, as Chief Justice pointed out, warrants are required to use GPS tracking devices, that more and more judges are going to be signing these orders to allow the installation of a GPS tracking device, that it is imperative that when a limitation is told to a judge in a warrant affidavit in pursuit of getting judicial authority to use a specific tracking device, the limitations that are stated by the officers to get that device should be determinative of what they can then go out and do within the scope of the warrant. Thank you.
Well, I have a question. Since you raised an issue about Jones, and I'm quickly rereading it, and both in the synopsis and in Scalia's opinion, he always uses the word search, but he uses it in quotes, so I'm not sure what the significance of the quotes are unless he's looking at the U.S. Constitution. But what bothered me when I read Jones, and I was trying to reread it quickly to see if I should be bothered, what was the search here? Was this, because search means trespass to Scalia.
In Jones, is that what you're asking?
In Jones.
Arguably, yes, that's how I would read it.
So was the trespass going into the engine on this car? So the trespass was inserting an object into the car? Or was the trespass getting the information about the public use of this car?
Quite frankly,
no, but my question is,
I do understand, Your Honor, and quite frankly, I don't think that the seizure in Jones,
search,
the meaningful intrusion in Mr. Jones's private property.
Yeah, what was it? Putting the GPS in, or tracking him?
I believe, according to Jones, that it's the device physically being in the vehicle is what was determinative for the majority in Jones. That was what made it a violation of the Fourth Amendment, was because the device was physically present inside of a vehicle that belonged to Jones, and therefore, under the law that came out, I believe, pre-Olmstead, constituted a Fourth Amendment violation because of its intrusion on the individual's property. In this case, I believe that they had a warrant that authorized them to so intrude. And I am not challenging that the intrusion went beyond the intrusion that was authorized under the warrant. I do not believe that is the case. And if that were my argument, I have no qualm about the fact that Jones would be dispositive. But to the contrary, the argument is more about the intrusion on his privacy, and that issue is, in my opinion, not decided.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to thank both Mr. Penix and Mr. O'Brien for their interesting arguments on continuing technology and the reasonable expectation of privacy and trespass relating to GPSs. That concludes our hearing on 10 AP 1366 CR, State versus James G. Brereton, and the court will meet in the conference room at 3:15. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, at which time we will hear three other cases that have been set for oral argument in this matter. So thank you both for coming.